From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Dr. Martin Blaser says when it comes to cells in the human body, we're way outnumbered by the outsiders. We have something like 30 trillion human cells that make up our bodies. But we also have microbes living with us, bacteria and viruses and fungi. And we have something like 100 trillion of those cells. They're everywhere, on your skin, in your mouth, your ears, mostly in your gut. And most of them are good, helpful. We've evolved alongside these microbes. But Dr. Blaser is worried that modern medicine is killing some of these bacteria and throwing the body out of balance. Today in the program, he'll join us to talk about his book called Missing Microbes. He's really worried about the overuse of antibiotics, which he believes is fueling a host of modern plagues. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It would be pretty easy to get creeped out by the reality of bacterial cells in the human body. There are more of these kinds of cells than human cells, and they're everywhere. Skin, mouth, nose, ear, stomach, of course. In his new book, Dr. Martin Blaser points out that altogether these bacteria weigh about 3 pounds. It's roughly the same weight as your brain. But it's good bacteria, mostly, and we're exposed to it the moment we're born. Blaser says this interaction between our bodies and these microbes, it's like an ecosystem, like a coral reef or a tropical jungle. It's a complex organization that mostly protects our bodies when it's balanced right. But starting about 70 years ago, when medicine began developing antibiotics, we started to throw off that balance. And in his new book, Blaser argues that over the last 20 years or so, we've reached a kind of tipping point where a host of what he calls modern plagues have been on the rise. We're talking obesity and asthma, hay fever and food allergies, even certain types of cancer and autism. And Blaser makes the case in his book that the overuse of antibiotics, along with other practices of modern medicine, like cesarean sections, for example, are at the heart of these ailments. Today in the program, Dr. Blaser is joining us. His book is called Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. You can join us. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Dr. Martin Blaser is the director of the Human Microbiome Program at New York University. He was formerly president of the Infectious Diseases Society of America. He's held major advisory roles in the National Institutes of Health. He's joining us today from a studio in New York City. And Dr. Blaser, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
I guess I wanted to start with the kind of the personal connection to this story, because you write about this in your book, your own journey to explore this subject, which you pinpoint the moment it began, as a matter of fact. This was in July 9th, 1977. You were asked to see a man who was there in a hospital bed, as you found him, shivering, you say, with fever. Start with that story, if you would.
Well, I'm a physician. I was a doctor in training. On July 1st, 1977, I began my fellowship in infectious diseases to become a specialist. And 9 days later, I was asked to see a very sick young man who had bacteria in his bloodstream and bacteria in his spinal fluid. He had meningitis. He was quite sick. He was comatose. And he had a very weird bacterium growing out of his blood. And as I began to study that bacteria, that's kind of what convinced me to study bacteria for the next 37 years, mm-hmm. Because this was a bacteria that could do all kinds of amazing gymnastics.
How is it, at what point you started studying all of this? And I guess your initial sense, like a lot of people, was antibiotics are good. They're of course, and this is still the case, of course, they are staving off these terrible diseases, those kinds of things. But at what point did you start to realize that maybe there was a more complicated story to tell.
Yeah. Yeah. So like every doctor and like everybody else, to me, antibiotics were one of the great miracles of the 20th century. People who had previously fatal, incurable diseases could be brought back to life with antibiotics and certain diseases prevented. Just like that patient I told you about, if there were no antibiotics, he would have died for sure. So like everyone, I gave antibiotics a clean bill of health. The only cloud on the horizon is that the more you use antibiotics, the more you select for bacteria that are resistant to them. And that is a big problem because the antibiotics are becoming less and less useful as resistance is growing. But I never thought that there were important safety concerns until about 10 years ago. And that's when a light bulb went off, because I remembered that farmers have been using antibiotics for the last 70 years on the farm to fatten up their livestock. Mm-hmm. It's what's called growth promotion. And it works so well that most of the antibiotics used in the United States are used expressly for that purpose, to fatten up farm animals. And the light bulb for me was, if giving antibiotics are making livestock fat, what are we doing to our children? What's the effect of all the antibiotics we're giving our kids? Mm. And that was the beginning of a leap. And then over the years, we've been doing research that indicates some of the problems that antibiotics are causing, including a propensity toward obesity.
You know, it's interesting. One of the things that you get at is the effect it has on the development process of children, of course. And it turns out one of the things, and we can come back to this a little bit later, but it turns out that the loss of this kind of friendly bacteria is making us – this is one of the insights you write about. It's making us taller, as well as fatter and a lot of other things. But that was interesting. And this idea of growth and the relationship between that and antibiotics is interesting. I wanted you to talk about that.
Well, that goes back actually about 15 years ago. As I said, I've been interested in bacteria for a long time. And I can't even tell you where I got the idea from. But as I think just about everybody knows, we've been getting taller. Since the beginning of the 20th century, people have been getting taller in the United States. Each generation is getting a little taller. In Europe, it's quite dramatic. In Asia, it's dramatic, but it started later, after World War II, in Japan, and maybe in the 1960s or later in China. And everywhere people are growing, most people think this is because of improved nutrition. And certainly that plays a role. With a medical student, I wrote a paper about 13 years ago about the idea that a change in early life bacteria may be fueling the rise in people's height. And we put together a body of information that supported that. And for example, armies have been keeping track of the height of their soldiers, of their recruits. So their records of how tall 18-year-old men are going back hundreds of years in many countries. And we can see that the heights go up and down. For example, the people in George Washington's army were taller than the soldiers in the Civil War. So it's not an inexorable rise, but it rises and falls. And skeletal remains in different places show that people were taller at one point, then they got shorter, then they got taller again. Now we're in a period of increasing height, but it seems to be leveling off.
Hmm. You say in the book, we live on a microbial planet. Life, as you say in the book, dominated by forms of life so small, too small to be seen by the naked eye. Talk a little bit about this, because for billions of years, that's what life was, bacteria. And this is an important part of the story, the early part of that. But talk a little bit about this is the essence of life, is this idea of bacteria churning, I suppose.
Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned it, because My book, Missing Microbes, is about human health. But in order to understand that, we have to understand the role of bacteria in all life on Earth. And as you point out, or I should say, that as far as we can tell, life on Earth began with bacteria about 4.5 billion years ago. And for the first 2 or 3 billion years, that's all there was, just bacteria. And then gradually, bigger forms of life began to emerge. But animals didn't even come on this planet till about 500 million years ago, which in terms of the billions isn't such a long time. In terms of our lives, 500 million years, a very long time. And that's when the earliest animals like worms came on the planet. And as far as we know, the earliest animals had bacteria living in them. They were colonized by what I call residential bacteria, bacteria that made those animals their homes. And as we've evolved over these millions and millions of years, we've carried our bacteria with us. As we've evolved, they've evolved. And in fact, they're part of our evolution. And that, for me, that was an important insight because I realized that they're part of our biology. They're part of our physiology. They're doing jobs for us. For example, they help us digest food.
Yeah.
They make vitamins for us. They train our immune system. They protect us against invaders. These are some of the most important functions. Bacteria are us, and we couldn't live without our good bacteria.
You know, it's interesting. You say that the story of microbes, you describe it as this saga of limitless warfare, but also endless cooperation. And it seems like it's that give and take that's going on, that natural selection is playing a role in the evolution of microbes. And they have these stable groups that work together. You mentioned these fossilized microbial mats that existed billions of years ago, which give us a sense that there were these sort of stable groups, but there's this fighting going on, and then there's this cooperation that's going on, and we sort of – so it's an interplay that goes on and has for billions of years.
Yeah, you've said it very well. As biologists, and after Charles Darwin, we've focused very much on the competition, the survival of the fittest, and we know that that's the central principle of biology. And yet, under certain circumstances, it pays to work together. And nature has figured out the solutions to that. So everywhere you look, there are examples of cooperation. Flowers and pollinators and big fish with little fish. Mm-hmm. And they've all worked out the rules over time, just as we have with our microbes that live in us. One of the interesting questions are these bacteria that we carry in our body by the trillions – why don't they kill us?
Right.
If they were just moved over 1 inch from our gut into our bloodstream, we would be instantly dead. Yet we live for decades in harmony, in some kind of cooperation together. So this is a very interesting frontier of medical science.
There was an organism that was discovered in the 1980s. It's a bacterium that plays an important role in the story that you write about. It started out as being called the – I don't even want to try to pronounce it – the GCLO takes on another –
Gastric
– go ahead.
Gastric campylobacter-like organism,
okay.
GCLO.
I mean this organism – go ahead because you described this as the bellwether, yeah.
Right. And the reason I got involved in it because the bacteria that I discussed that caused that 33-year-old patient to be so sick, that was a campylobacter also.
Yeah.
And that chance encounter – with a patient who had a campylobacter growing in his bloodstream really marked my career because I started following campylobacters for the next years. And then a few years later, a new campylobacter was discovered in the stomach called gastric campylobacter-like organism. Today it has a different name, but that's how I got started in it because it was just a cousin of the guys I was studying.
What's important about this particular story? Because you talk about Dr. Barry Marshall, who discovered the bacterium, and he figured, you know, if we got rid of it, if we could eradicate it with antibiotics, we could cure ulcers. And this is the sort of give and take of this story, the good and the bad. And I suppose in some ways it worked, but at the time they had no idea what that might have meant, what the other part of that story might be, I guess.
Well, again, it's like so many stories. It's very complicated and has many different layers. When Marshall and Warren discovered the organism in the late 1970s, early 1980s, they showed very strongly that this was connected with ulcer disease, with people having ulcers in their stomach and in their duodenum, a very serious and significant disease. And they showed that if you treat patients with antibiotics and get rid of the organism, their ulcers will go away and they won't come back. This is a huge breakthrough in medicine. It changed the whole approach to ulcer treatment. And in fact, they won the Nobel Prize for that because it was such a fundamental shift. But what was interesting is that they did this work in Australia in the late 20th century. But people in Germany had found the organism 100 years earlier. But they found it in everyone's stomach. And they just concluded it's just one of the normal organisms. And first it was ignored and then it was forgotten. And by the time they rediscovered it, it was only present in half the people's stomach. And then they could use that information to understand its relationship to disease or not. And I began to ponder that this was a normal organism that was disappearing. And because everything seemed to suggest it was a very ancient organism that had been with humans for a long time, I postulated that maybe it's doing us some good as well. Not only does it do us harm, but it may be doing us some good. And ultimately, we found that good, and we found it in a few different areas.
It's so interesting that we're born. When we're born, we're sterile. But almost immediately, we start to develop our own microbiome. Talk a little bit about this, because this begins, I guess, in the birth process.
Yeah. So when a baby's in the womb, in their mother's uterus, as far as we can tell, they're sterile. There are no bacteria. That is, during healthy birth, there always can be problems. And then their introduction to the world of bacteria begins when the mom's water breaks and bacteria from the birth canal start to rush in. And now the baby's being pushed out from the womb through the birth canal. And as it's coming out from its mom, it's being covered with the mom's bacteria. The skin is covered by it. The baby is swallowing it. And when the baby is born, that final expulsion, it's covered with mom's bacteria. And that's how mammals have been doing it for the last more than 100 million years, whether they're humans or elephants or dolphins. It's all the same thing. That's how it's always been. But things are different today. One of the important differences is that more and more babies are being born by cesarean section.
Right.
And during cesarean section, they're missing that whole process. And one might say, well, what does it matter? And I can answer this on two levels. Firstly, bacteriologically, it does matter. Because the initial bacteria that those babies are born with who are born from C-section are different than the babies who are born the regular way, vaginally. And there now have been a number of epidemiologic studies, including studies that we've done, that have looked at groups of kids born by C-section or born normally that show differences in disease risk. These include studies that show that kids born by C-section are more likely to become obese, to develop juvenile diabetes, to develop celiac disease and other allergic disorders. And the field is growing to suggest that that early, that very first exposure to bacteria, to mom's bacteria, is especially important.
So what do you do about that? I mean, can you expose the baby to the microbes of its mother's vagina even though it's being born by C-section? Can that be done?
It can be done. But before I answer that question, what's important for your listeners to know is that we're doing C-sections at an amazing rate. C-sections go back to the time of Julius Caesar, 2,000 years ago. But in the old days, the mother almost always died. The baby could survive, but the mother died. But about a century ago, C-sections became safe due to advances in surgery and anesthesia so that both baby and mother would survive. And in the early years of the 20th century and to the mid-century, C-section rates were maybe 5%, 10%. And then they started to rise. And 20 years ago in the U.S., it was 18%. And today, it's almost 33%. One baby out of three is being born by C-section. In Brazil, it's about 50%. In urban China, it's 50%. In Rome, it's over 80%, although in other parts of Italy it's lower. And it's not that the women in Rome have different pelvises. This reflects differences in practice and custom. And everybody thinks that a C-section is kind of biologically free. They can have all the advantages of a C-section, but there aren't any important costs. Well, one cost is that the microbiome is different.
Yeah.
And we're learning how important that is.
What do we know about C-sections in Utah, for example? I mean, you have a map there that gives you a sense of where Utah might be in the scheme of things.
Well, as I told you, the national average is about 33%. In Utah, it's one of the lowest in the country. It's about 22%. So Utah is about 50% better than – I'm considering this high rate is bad.
Sure, sure.
And Utah is about 50% better. And I've talked to some colleagues, and they suggest that because so many women in Utah are planning to have multiple pregnancies, and one of the general customs is that if you've once had a C-section, you're always going to have a C-section. So, you know, if you're planning 6 or 7 or 8 births, those later C-sections get more and more complicated. So they start – the doctors and the women start much earlier to try to avoid the C-section. And it looks like they're successful half the time, or a third of the time. That's assuming that all other things are equal. So Utah is actually ahead. And there are places in Sweden where the C-section rates are 5%.
Yeah.
And we don't – we're not seeing any higher rates of child deformations or fetal death or anything like that. I think that our tendency to do C-sections has been uncontrolled. It's gone a little amok.
Well, it relates to – which we'll come back to – the overuse of antibiotics. And it seems like one of the things you've got to overcome when you're talking about all of this is – I'm not sure even how you'd describe it. There's, a cultural dimension to it perhaps. Maybe it's a question of convenience or – I mean, how do you explain all of that, the thing that you need to overcome to sort of get at this issue?
Well, let's just shift for the moment to antibiotics. Well, let me just finish up one thing about C-sections.
Okay.
And that is that actually Dr. Maria Gloria Dominguez, who happens to be my wife – did one of the initial studies showing the difference in the microbiome between C-section and vaginal. And she did that with Dr. Rob Knight at the University of Colorado. So it's not too far from your region. And she's been thinking about this and she developed a technique where now she's doing a study of three groups of women, vaginal birth, C-section birth, and then women who are going to have C-sections – in which she puts a swab in the vagina. And now when the baby is born, that swab is applied to the baby's skin and the baby's mouth so that she can restore the microbes that the baby missed coming out by the C-section. They're just in the middle of a study of that, but she's going to report some of the results at a big national meeting next month.
So you're up against Brazil, how do you describe that? How do you explain, for example, the propensity in Brazil versus the propensity in a place like Utah? I mean, what accounts for that?
Well, medicine is complex, and you would say, well, C-section, that's a sign of an advanced culture.
Yeah.
But the countries that have the lowest rates of C-section are the Scandinavian countries and the Netherlands. And some of the countries that have the highest rates are Ecuador and Iran and Brazil. Countries that we don't necessarily associate with the most advanced medical care, so it's a little hard to understand. Let me shift, if I might, to antibiotics.
Sure.
Because there are a lot of parallels here. Last year, the CDC, Centers for Disease Control, did a national study of antibiotic use across the United States in the year 2010. And what they found is that there were 258 million prescriptions of antibiotics for people in the U.S. And that comes out to 5 prescriptions of antibiotics for every 6 people. And the CDC data and from conversations I've had that suggests that this has been going on year after year after year. So the amount of antibiotic use, 833 courses per 1,000 population, is just enormous. What was particularly interesting to me is that they showed that there was big regional variation. In the Northeast and the Midwest, it was right around at the national average. In the West, including Utah, it was the rate instead of 833 in the country, it was 638 per 1,000. And in the South, it was 936. The difference between the West and the South was almost 50%. Yet there is not a 50% difference in the rate of serious bacterial infections. That difference reflects differences in practice and in custom. Doctors and patients are much more comfortable with antibiotics in the West than in the South. And when the CDC looked at the data, you could extrapolate from it and see that the average child in the U.S. receives about 4 courses of antibiotics by the time they're 3. That's across all kids. By the time they're 10, they have about 10 courses. By the time they're 20, they have 17 courses. These numbers seem high, but they're consistent with many other much smaller studies. And what I want to tell you about is about Sweden, another advanced country where people are at least as healthy as we are. And at every age, the Swedes are using only 40% of the antibiotics we're using. So our children by 3 have had 4 courses. They've had 1.4. When our children have had 10 courses, their children have had 4 courses at the age of 10. So somehow the Swedes are getting it right. And it suggests that 60% of the antibiotics we're using are completely unneeded.
Is there an awareness in Sweden about the risks of overuse of antibiotics, or is there a different kind of practice that may account for it? I mean, are they aware of all of this, and is that the reason they're scaling back, or do they just happen to be lucky? You know, it's an effect of something else that's going on in their system.
Well, if you look at a map of Europe, you find that antibiotic use varies a lot between countries. They use a lot of antibiotics in France, but not that many in Sweden. So it has something to do with the national culture. And the U.S., we're using a lot of antibiotics. But interestingly, it is suggested that the use in China is far greater than in the U.S. In the U.S., you have to get a prescription from a doctor to use an antibiotics. In China, they're available over the counter. And when people don't feel well, they just take an antibiotic. And so it's estimated that the use in China is 2 to 4 times as much as ours. Nobody actually knows the real numbers. So it has something to do with the national culture. But for me as a medical scientist, what's important is that a lot of it is unnecessary. And not only that, but it has a cost. And that's in Missing Microbes, I try to go into some of those costs.
Yeah. I want to get to that when we get back from a break. Dr. Martin Blaser is with us. His book is called Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. We invite you to join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're continuing our series on health and fitness with a conversation about the trillions of tiny critters who live in our guts and on our bodies. They're foreign bacteria, but for hundreds of thousands of years, we've lived together. They don't hurt us. They protect us. Dr. Martin Blaser is our guest. He says the overuse of antibiotics and other modern medical practices, in fact, part of it also is our obsession with hygiene, is killing off this ecosystem living in our bodies, which is causing an alarming rise in a number of disturbing things: obesity, food allergies, autism. His book is called Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. You can join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Couple of questions that are coming in. One of them is, can you reverse the process now? If you have children being born to young people who already had their immune systems compromised by antibiotics, can they really even pass on a healthy microbiome? So, you know, does it matter all that much about the antibiotics at this point if we've already stripped away some of those from a previous generation, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. We have hypothesized that the situation is actually getting worse, that each generation has lost microbes. And so the moms of 3 generations ago, some of the first moms getting antibiotics, when their kids were born, they had lost microbes, and now their daughters are passing on fewer, and it's been stepping down with each generation. That's a pretty bleak assessment. But in fact, there's some evidence that supports that this actually has been happening. So we have to stop the onslaught against our microbiome with unnecessary antibiotics, unnecessary procedures, unnecessary sanitizers, and other things that potentially impact our good microbes. And then we have to develop strategies for replacement. I predict in the book, and in fact I predicted 15 years ago, that we're going to be giving Helicobacter pylori back to children so that they can have their ancestral organism back again. Mm. And I think the doctors of the future are going to be doing this. But we have to discover which are the right ones to give back and when. And if the right one to give back to your child is the same as the right one to give back to my child.
I think this is what people think they're doing when they take probiotics. They figure they're reintroducing the good bacteria back into their guts. But this is something you write about in the book. It's not really exactly very regulated very well in this country, and we don't really know what probiotics are doing in some cases.
You know, you go to a supermarket or a drugstore or a health food store, there are shelves and shelves with containers of materials called probiotics. I can say three things for sure. One is that these are almost entirely unregulated. Second is that they're almost entirely untested. And third is that they're generally safe. But I don't know whether they have any real benefit or not, because there's so many. They're so various. And, you know, if we've lost hundreds of species of bacteria, I don't know what taking one of them is really going to do for us. Mm.
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Let's take some calls. Let's start with Julia, who's joining us from Provo. Julia, welcome.
Hi. I just had a question for Dr. Blaser. I wanted to hear his opinion on I have had a lot of friends that have their list of foods they are unable to eat because it disagrees with them now. It gets longer and longer, it seems, every year. And I was wondering if he believes this has to do with the overuse of antibiotics, or if it's the fact that we can't absorb the vitamins that help us produce the stomach acid, because I it seems that so many people I know have this problem, and it's just recently. I can take my answer off the air.
Well, this is what you mean by modern plagues, is it not, Dr. Blaser?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I was growing up, you know, peanut allergy was extremely rare, yeah. And celiac disease was extremely rare, and these have just skyrocketed. These are some of what I call the modern plagues. And again, every indication is that they're getting worse. And I believe, and we actually have some evidence from our experiments in mice, that it is as a result of our changing microbes, and it is induced by antibiotics, because the early microbes that we have in our body, those our early residents, they're doing good things for us. They're help training our immune system to grow up in a healthy manner. And without them, our immune system is getting defective training, and we're selecting for different populations of immune cells than we used to have. And to me, that's some of the fuel. And one of the questions, of course, is how can we turn it around in the existing generations? What's the window of opportunity? When you pass a certain age, is it too late? Or is there a window really at almost any time?
What are you saying to this, what seems to be an emergence of fecal transplants? They're becoming an option for people. You know, you take fecal matter from somebody and transplant it into somebody else. Is that a solution? Is that something that you see as restoring some of the good bacteria in people?
That is a solution, but in a very limited number of people. There's a terrible infection due to bacteria in the gastrointestinal tract called Clostridium difficile. We call it C. diff for short. And we've known now for about 40 years that when people take antibiotics, they can get an overgrowth of this normal bacterium, C. diff, and it can wreak havoc on their intestines. And sometimes you can treat it with further antibiotics and make it go away. That works about two-thirds of the time. But in a third of the case, they get episode after episode after episode. And in some cases, people lose a lot of weight, and occasionally people die from it. So it's a lethal disease. Mm-hmm. And it was found that doctors did clinical trials where they gave people who had the C. diff infection, they gave them the fecal transplant from healthy people, and they cured them. And in fact, they did it in a blinded, controlled study, standard therapy versus fecal transplant. And in fact, they had to stop the study because the fecal transplant was so far superior. So this proves the principle mm-hmm. that if you can restore a damaged gut ecosystem, you can cure a disease. Now, that's a very extreme case, but it proves the principle. And now scientists are trying to find out what are the active ingredients in that fecal transplant. Maybe we could do this in a much more standard way, a way that's a little less repulsive. But then others are saying, well, maybe we can do this for other kinds of intestinal problems. But those are just beginning to be studied now. I wouldn't advise people to do it at home.
Yeah. Julia, thanks. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Barbara is with us in Salt Lake. Barbara, hi.
Hi there. I've always enjoyed your program so much. And I have a question about antibiotics being used as a prophylactic. I'm one of those lucky people who has had hip implants for replacements. And every time I go to the dentist, I'm supposed to take a course of a broad-spectrum antibiotic. And to be honest, when I hear what's happening in my gut, this makes me pretty concerned. I'd just like a response to, is this a safe procedure, or should this be cut out and take your chances?
Well, you ask a very good question. And in order to answer your question, first let me tell you that until recently, again, everybody gave antibiotics a free ride. We could see the benefit from antibiotics, but we didn't really see the cost. And so if something has benefit, you would say, okay, I'm going to use it because there may be one patient out of 100, there may be one patient out of 1,000 who'll be helped. And if there's just benefit, then you would use that all the time. And that's what's happened in dentistry, is that there are certain kinds of conditions where the risk of infection is very, very low. And so the dentist thought, it's low, but why should it ever happen? So we're going to give antibiotics for hundreds or thousands of people just to prevent one infection. And now the clock is moving, and more dentists and physicians are understanding that there are many conditions for which antibiotics are not needed prophylactically or preventively. But that's a frontier. And again, you should work with your dentist about, is for your particular condition, are antibiotics still indicated or not? And the list has been shortening, so it may not be necessary anymore. But what we're going to have to do is recalibrate what we understand about cost and benefit, and not just financial cost, it's biological cost, it's health cost. Mm.
One of the things you write about is that we need to really, in the medical system, develop more narrow spectrum antibiotics as well. Get more pinpointed, I guess, in some way.
Yeah, the whole drive for antibiotic development starting in the 1940s was broad spectrum antibiotics. Yeah. Somebody comes in sick, and they're not wearing a sign. I have bacteria X or I have bacteria Y. So you want to give an antibiotic that will cover the whole waterfront of likely suspects. But now our technologies are getting better and better, and we have it in our power. If not now, then pretty soon, that we're going to be able to say, this person who's sick, they have bacteria X. Mm-hmm. And we should be able to take a narrow-spectrum antibiotic off the shelf that's just targeted to X and will not have collateral damage. That's what we need to develop. We have the knowledge about the particular bacteria now. There has never been an economic incentive to develop narrow-spectrum antibiotics until now. Mm-hmm. But I think that's going to be the medicine of the future.
Barbara, thanks. Back to the phones. Let's talk to Celeste in Salt Lake. Celeste, hi.
Hi. This question I'm asking generally, but also somewhat personally because of an experience I've had. I wonder if there have been any formal studies done on restoring gut flora and fauna and bacteria by use of traditional fermented foods or potentially like whole organic foods, things like miso, natural vinegars, sauerkraut. And I ask this because I spent 20 years fighting gut problems, really, really major ones.
Yeah, and that was helpful to you?
Various diagnoses, and this has helped me.
Yeah. Doctor, what do you think?
The first thing to say is that remember that a lot of these techniques were developed as food preservatives in the days before refrigeration. If you fermented things, they would last longer. And so it was a form of ways of storing food. Having said that, just about all the foods that you mentioned, I love. They're delicious. I try to eat them as much as possible. But whether that is helping my microbiome or not, I don't know. Again, those are the bacteria that are in those are bacteria that are adapted to those particular foods.
Yeah.
They're not necessarily adapted to the human body. I'm concerned about the bacteria that our ancestors used to have that we're missing, and the bacteria that are in fermented foods, the bacteria that are in soil. You know, some people think if you're a good parent, you should have your kids eat dirt. But the bacteria in dirt are adapted for soil. They're not adapted for people.
Well, this is a theme that comes up from time to time in your book, this idea that our microbiomes, it's very personal. I mean, these are things that are particular to us, so it may be hard to translate. I mean, there are some general principles involved, but a lot of this is quite – is that the right word, personal?
Personal, and it's also somewhat undefined.
Yeah.
I actually am a strong believer in probiotics. I think that's going to be the future, but it's not necessarily the probiotics that are on the shelf today. Mm. I think we're going to need science to develop to understand which are the probiotics we really need, which are the ancient organisms that have gone missing that we have to restore, not necessarily the organisms that live in cheese, for example.
Dr. Martin Blaser is with us. His book is called Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. You can join us 801-585-WEST, our email address radiowest@kuer.org. Celeste, thanks very much for the call. We'll get to more of you when we get back from a break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Dr. Martin Blaser. We're talking about his new book, Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. 801-585-WEST, the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's go back to the phones. Let's see. Mark is with us in Sandy, Utah. Mark, hi.
Hi. Thank you very much. In 1968, I was diagnosed, I was in the military and diagnosed with ulcers in London. And then later in the 70s, or maybe even the early 80s, my doctor prescribed this regimen of antibiotics, actually combined with Pepto-Bismol, and a very complex schedule to eradicate H. pylori in my system. And it was apparently successful. I still suffer from reflux, and I take medications for that. I'm wondering if I should consult my physician about maybe reintroducing the Helicobacter pylori to my system at this point in my life. I'm in my mid-60s.
It's a question that comes up, Dr. Blaser, in your book, this idea, the rise of heartburn as a reaction to antibiotics. Talk about that.
Yeah. So... heartburn was understood by doctors for many years, but it really looks like the rise began in the 1930s and has just been increasing dramatically ever since then. Heartburn seems to be a relatively modern disease. And then there's a condition related to that called Barrett's esophagus. And then there's a form of cancer, adenocarcinoma of the esophagus or of the gastroesophageal junction, which is actually the fastest rising cancer in the United States. And all of these have come up in the late 20th century, just at the time that Helicobacter is disappearing. And now there have been a number of studies that show, in brief, they show that Helicobacter pylori is bad for your stomach. People who have it have a higher rate of getting ulcers and have a higher rate of getting stomach cancer. But it seems to be good for your esophagus. People who have it have a lower rate of esophageal diseases, including that esophageal cancer. So you can't win. And your case of eradicating Helicobacter and developing reflux symptoms or heartburn is actually somewhat typical. In Missing Microbes, I discussed my own case where I got rid of Helicobacter. Actually, I had no symptoms whatsoever, but I was worried about the bacteria. And I got rid of it, and I began to have reflux a few months later for the first time in my life. And that caught my attention. And then we did other studies showing this, that Helicobacter is actually protective against reflux.
Thanks very much for the call. 801-585-WEST, again, the number to join the conversation. This question has been coming up quite a bit, and you write about these antibacterial gels and soaps and those kinds of things. Ben from Salt Lake wants to know, how can I improve my own microbiome? Should I shower less? Should I wash my hands less? What do you think?
Yeah, what's remarkable to me is that the antibacterial gels and soaps, they're very useful in certain limited circumstances. When you're in a hospital where there are a lot of antibiotic-resistant germs around, it's very important to prevent the transmission of these germs from one hospital patient to another, from one susceptible person to another. And so that's a great setting for those soaps. During the flu season, it's very important because flu can be transmitted by hands as well. But most of the time, we're not in hospitals, and it's not flu season. Yet people are using these hand sanitizers and antibacterial soaps and antibacterial everything tens of millions of times a day across the country. And there's essentially no evidence that this has any benefit at all. And my question is whether it's doing more good or it's doing more harm by hurting the good bacteria. Considering the scale that we're doing it as a society, we really need to know the answers, whether this is good for us or not. And in terms of restoring our microbes, this is the area that we and a number of other people are doing research on to try to figure out what are the organisms that we don't want to lose, what are the ones we want to get back.
801-585-WEST, the number two. Join the conversation. Let's go back to the phones. Let's see. Scott is with us in Salt Lake. Scott, hi.
Hi. I was just wondering, the guest mentioned that in Sweden, which is a colder climate, the use of antibiotics was less. I'm wondering if the studies show that there's any, that the climate of an area, whether it's warmer or colder, has any effect on the microbes that can exist in the body.
Again, I think that the in the southeast of the United States, they use a lot more antibiotics than in the southwest. They're both pretty hot places. In France, they did, where I told you they have a lot of very high rates of antibiotic use. The government was very concerned about this, and they made a concerted campaign, which I discuss in my book, to lower antibiotic usage. And they could show within a few years they could cut antibiotic use by 30%. So the climate was the same, but they changed the practice. And I think that we know that one of the main uses of antibiotics is in kids who have ear infections. But we also know that 80% of those ear infections are due to viruses. Yet doctors are prescribing antibiotics. Patients are happy to take antibiotics for their children. Patients, when the doctor doesn't give an antibiotic, they feel deprived. So one of the reasons I wrote Missing Microbes is to begin to try to change this dialogue for people to understand that if the doctor does a careful exam and says your child doesn't need an antibiotic, you should be happy.
Yeah.
Because then your child won't be exposed to something that could be damaging to them in their later life.
Well, and something you also point out is that these decisions, you shouldn't have to worry about it yourself. These are decisions that should be made by your doctor. You know, it isn't something that where you have to, I mean, hopefully doctors are going to be more aware of all of this stuff because they're the ones you should be listening to, I suppose.
Yeah, I think what's happened is that we've gone to a relatively extreme point. The patient, everybody wants antibiotics. They think there's benefit, but they don't understand there's cost. The doctors don't want to offend the patients, and they think, well, you know, there might be a little benefit. Again, nobody's counting on the costs. And if we can change that dialogue, and I'm speaking to a lot of medical groups now about the same subject. I'm trying to change both sides of the dialogue. Mm-hmm. So we understand that there's cost from this very common practice, and we can step back from that abyss.
One of the things you write about, and we already went through this question of antibiotics being used. As you point out in the book, most antibiotics produced in the U.S. don't go to humans. They go to feedlots and industrial farms. Do those antibiotics come to us by way of the food that we take in?
Sometimes they do. There have been surveys in supermarkets showing trace amounts of antibiotics in meats, in milk that children drink. And for some cities, their drinking water supply is downstream of the effluent from these industrial farms. So as far as we can tell, millions of people are being exposed to trace levels of antibiotics every day. But we don't know what the consequence of that is. Mm. That's something that's really important to be studied. We need to know the answers to that.
Let me ask you this finally. You write in the book that, as with global warming, there's a risk that the status quo is locked in. But you say the moment for change is now, and it sounds like you seem fairly optimistic, at least at this point, about turning things around.
You know, first you have to recognize that there's a problem, and I think we're there. We understand it. I think we need to cut down antibiotic usage, which is doable. We look at the example of Sweden. We need to do research, so we develop narrow-spectrum antibiotics. We need to develop better diagnostics so we can tell who's got a viral infection and doesn't need antibiotics and who has a bacterial infection. And we're beginning to understand what are some of the ancient organisms. And again, I'm predicting that we're going to be giving them to healthy kids to replace the ones that have been lost over these decades of development so we can have our cake and eat it, so we can be free of some of the terrible germs that have plagued us in the past but not lose our friends.
Dr. Martin Blaser, his book is called Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. He joined us from a studio in New York City. Dr. Blaser, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you so much.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.